This thing on? This thing's not. Thank you. So your regularly scheduled minister, who we just hired not too long ago, is not here. I'll be your sermon server for the week. And Fenton is on assignment. He is actually in Auburn, Alabama, preaching to the Auburn Tuskegee Church. And that's exciting. It's very exciting to Robert Lingle, who's a big Alabama fan, to think that Fenton is preaching the word to the lost souls of Auburn. So, you know what's funny is right before this morning when I got here, Trevor Toth came up to me and said, you know, it was really a smart PR move of you to have them bring back coffee service on the day that you preach. So people will be tempted to come and not like, you know, well, Fenton's not here, so I'm not going to come. So thank you for that. Thank you for showing up. When I was really young, I used to have a recurring nightmare that I was in the back seat of an old car being driven by no one. And it was pretty scary, and I could see the steering wheel moving. I could see the neighborhood going by, and it was always like a thunderstorm was coming up. It was scary, and but you know, it's all a matter of perspective, because you know, on the one hand, you know, if you're one of the people that look into, you know, what does this dream really mean? You know, are you fearful that your life is out of control and you're being taken somewhere that you don't really know and you don't really want to go? Or, at the age of 4, was I already thinking about the concept of self-driving automobiles that are going to be adding 17 trillion dollars to the global economy in the next few decades? It's all a matter of your perspective. But, you know, in this case, it was the scary one, because, trust me on this, only one of those scenarios would cause someone to wet the bed. So, perspective is everything. And pretty much, it all boils down for all of us, how I look at things or how I feel about things. So when different things happen to you, when you have different feelings, different dreams, whatever it is, it's all in, you know, how do I choose to look at that? You know, things that happen at work or things that happen in your family or in life, how do I choose to look at that? How does it make me feel? And it all boils down to the stories we tell ourselves. Whoops. Too far. The stories we tell ourselves. And I've lost the microphone. The story I'm telling myself is that I move my head too much when I speak. So, sorry about that. So what about these stories? Do you have stories that you tell yourself about things that are going on in your life? If you've ever heard of the author Brené Brown, that's a big thing for her. She talks about shame and guilt. And one of the things that she talks about is, you know, that's just the story you're telling yourself. And I've thought about that over the last few years. I read a book, and in some cases, the story you tell about yourself is true. In some cases, they're right. In most cases, though, they're lies. And it's the classic battle between what's right, what's wrong, what's the truth, and what's a lie. Let's look at this scripture, though. In John 10:10, Jesus is speaking about being the good shepherd, the perfect shepherd of caring for all the sheep, protector of the flock. But listen to what he says about Satan. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Honestly, in your heart, would you say that the life you're living right now is the life you dream of and the life that is full? Don't have to raise your hand. But if it's not, there's something missing. If something's off, it's not the life that you're saying, I'm not living life to the full. What is it that the thief has stolen from you? What is it in that story that you're believing? What is it, are you aware, are you even aware that you're telling yourself these stories? Or have you heard them so much that they've just become ingrained in who you are and what you believe about yourself? So I asked myself, I took a formal poll, myself was one of the people, and a few people in our congregation about what are some of the stories you tell yourself that you believe about yourself. Now, if we were going to be here all day, which I don't plan on, you know, big sigh of relief, there'd be lots of stories, but here's the ones that are true for me and true for several people. This one is particularly personable for me. I've missed my calling. It may surprise some of you that I have a pretty vivid imagination, and I was known as a class clown in high school and middle school, elementary school, preschool, before school, and I chose to think it was just a way for me, seeing the humor in things, to just entertain myself because I was bored. And pretty soon, as people started laughing at things that I did, or at me, they didn't really say, I came to think, like, you know, I like making people laugh. I like finding the humor in things, and I like making people laugh. And so, right or wrong, I choose to see a sense of humor as a gift. Now, trust me, I know my humor is not to everybody's taste here. I've gotten anonymous letters telling me that, so I get it. I'm not everybody's cup of tea. But if I can entertain myself on jury duty or traveling or just making observations about life, if it keeps me motivated and somebody else gets a kick out of it, then amen. I'm happy, and I've spent my time doing things good. What's particularly challenging about this statement is a while back, I went to my 20-year high school reunion, and you're thinking, like, yeah, but that was a long time ago. But it was particularly at my 20-year, and I sat next to somebody that I had known since first grade. And I went to school in Mobile, Alabama. I'd already moved to Atlanta, and we hadn't kept in touch a lot. And so she ended up sitting at our table, and we hung out. We had a gang of kids in high school and middle school, so we knew each other pretty well. We had a small class, and she knew me pretty well and had seen some of the antics that I had done. And so she said, "So what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a training manager in an insurance company." And she got this crestfallen look on her face, and she goes, "Oh, well, I really thought you would have done something with the whole comedy thing, you know, just writing or cartooning or something like that." And I remember thinking, "Oh, yeah, I really thought I was going to do that too, but that's tough." You know, and there's lots of people when, you know, I say something funny or get jury duty and, you know, post, you know, random thoughts. If you don't follow me on Facebook, the reason I reference jury duty is when I get jury duty, I tend to just make observations throughout the day while I'm there about just what's going on in the process. And a few people here like it. And so sometimes I'll get the comment like, "Oh, Tim, you've missed your calling." And I know that's meant as a compliment, but to me, it's like a dagger in my heart. Because I feel like, really? Did I really miss my calling? So my thought is, you know, did I really miss my calling? Or is this what I'm supposed to be doing? It doesn't really feel like it all the time. So I came up with my excuse, my answer to that. Somebody says, "Oh, Tim, you missed your calling." My standard response is, "I didn't miss my calling. I happened to be on the other line at the time." But I still wonder, was I meant for something else? And The story I tell myself, this sounds pretty convincing. Did I miss my calling? Because, you know, it's a good thing if you use your gifts, whatever they are or however you define them, to serve God, right? Or to use them in life and to live life to the full. I use the YouVersion Bible on my phone and my iPad, and I go through a lot of their devotionals, and there are 5 different devotionals on that app that talk about calling. And I've learned a lot from that, and one of the biggest things is there's a difference between your calling and your career. And when I read that, I thought, oh, thank goodness. But again, what's my calling? And then I thought, as more have I read in these great studies that talk about what you're called to do, is your greatest calling is to be a follower of Jesus. Anything else is secondary. Using whatever gift, whether it's humor or organization or administration or whatever those gifts are, is you use it along that purpose of following Jesus. There's a popular saying out there that says, you know, find a job you enjoy doing and you'll never work a day in your life. Have you heard that? Yep. Do you believe that? I believe it's true for the few people who find that job. I just haven't found somebody that's willing to pay me to come to their office and sit around and make comments about on conference calls or at meetings or just what's going on. If you have an opening or you know of something I could do where there is a market for that, I'll give you my resume after church. So let's look at what the Bible has to say. Each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful servants of God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, they should do so as the one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. So regardless of what I do for a living or whatever I do, whatever I get a paycheck for, I can trust that if I'm using whatever my gifts are in some way in following Jesus, whether it's to make somebody smile or make light of a heavy situation they're going through to help them get through it, then I'm following my true calling. That helps me to not think that, you know, what if there was some magical career out there that I just missed the boat, you know, because I didn't pursue it. But if I'm answering the call of Jesus, I'm answering the call. The next one that I've heard is I don't have any gifts. And my response to that is, oh yeah, you do. There is no shortage of assessments, quizzes, StrengthsFinder tools. Any of you that have been in any sort of corporate environment, HR really likes to put on these seminars to talk about what are your strengths? What is it you bring to the workplace? You know, we want you to bring your whole self to work. In my case, no, you don't. They want you to find out what you're really good at, what you're passionate about. And so to open this collaborative space where everybody can get along, I even found yesterday, there's a quiz on the internet where you can find out what your spiritual gifts are for free. Yes, I did take it. I'm not going to tell you what they are, because I don't really know. It was the internet, so. But it's my belief that everyone has gifts. So look at what this says here. In the same way, though we are many, we are one body in union with Christ, and we are all joined to each other as different parts of one body. So we are to use our different gifts in accordance with the grace that God has given us. Note that it doesn't say, if you find yourself in some possession of a gift, here's what you ought to do about it. The assumption is, everybody's got a gift. What's hard is figuring out what that gift is, aside from taking a quiz on the internet. The best way you can do that is to really think and pray and ask God, what is my gift? What is it you want me to be doing? What is my calling? What is it that I should do in following you? It starts back in verse 4 of the same scripture. Whoops, wrong way. If our gift is to speak God's message, we should do it according to the faith that we have. If it is to serve, we should serve. If it is to teach, we should teach. If it is to encourage others, we should do so. Whoever shares with others should do it generously. Whoever has authority should work hard. Whoever shows kindness to others should do it cheerfully. So we've got a lot of examples of people using their gifts in our congregation. More so than I would have thought. So I gave myself a few minutes yesterday, and I rattled off as many ideas as I could. Now, if I don't mention your name, it's not because I don't think you have a gift. It's just I gave myself a minute, and here's what I came up with. Laura Baker, encouragement. Carol Garner, goodness. Kathy Jack, teaching and loving our children in Kids Rock. Mason Mathias, Mike Mathias, Mary Mathias, Chris Legue, Bethany Lingle, Michael Linger, Robert Lingle, Lexi Washburn, Carly Shortland, Byron Word, Andy McKay, Heidi McKay, Chuck Neely, Cindy Albert, Boomy, Evan Gunnels, Virgil Welch, Tiffany Welch, Angela Turner, singing and making music. Remember back a year ago, we were wondering, like, you know, what are we going to do about the worship ministry? It's not really as lively. We don't really have the talent that we used to have. I don't know how many names that is. We've got a lot of talent. These people chose to step up and say, you know what? I'm willing to sing. I am willing to stand up there in front of a microphone and either I will lip sync the words or I will sing to the best of my alto, bass, soprano abilities, and the rest of us, you know, get the blessing of that. And you know, I was sitting next to Paul Peeler today, and I got to hear him sing. So he and I are good friends, but we don't always sit together at church, which is better for everybody. Paul's got a really good voice. Paul could be a side singer, which I told him this, and he's probably slinking in his seat. But he's got a really good voice. So if we need to add to the dozen or so people, you know, something happens to these folks when they go out on tour, especially those of you that are in families. Like, I can picture, you know, the Mathias family going on the road, or, you know, the Welch family, or the Lingle family. I mean, I can already envision that YouTube channel. The Lingle's in a bus. Today we're in Pascagoula, Mississippi, singing the word. There's more. Roger and Colleen Bennett, compassion and serving. Tom and Kathy Nesbitt, serving. Ned Benson, faith. Jennifer Acosta, kindness. And my wife's not here today because she's at her class reunion in Connecticut. Hopefully not telling some, you know, having to tell the story I did of, you know, so what did you do with your life? My wife's gift is joy and, of course, patience. As you can well imagine. So we could spend the rest of the day here kind of doing a strengths assessment, and I could, you know, go through and I could guess what I think your gift is, just what I observe at church. But if you don't know what your gift is, you could take, you know, a test, or you could pray about it, but you could also find someone that knows you really well and say, what do you think my gift is? Yeah. They'll be honest with you. They'll be honest. Because your gift is to serve all of us. And this is the best crowd to serve, because if you don't do it well, nobody hates you. Different times when people have, you know, been asked to do communion or the announcements and they haven't done it before, I would talk to them beforehand. He said, I'm just really nervous. And I go, look, this is the crowd. If you're going to do it, it's the best crowd to do it in front. You don't want to do it in front of people at work. You know, not so much the love as you'll get at this place. These people will hug you and bless your heart and then move on. So Don't listen to the story that tells you you don't have gifts, because it's not true. It's a lie of Satan. Next one is, God doesn't hear my prayers. My character flaws are why I'm going through hard times. You know, it's no secret, in the last several years, different people in our congregation have gone through crippling and very difficult times. Health, family, relationships, finances, health of kids, death, divorce, addiction, you name it. There are people here that are probably struggling with things that we don't even know about right now because they haven't talked about it. And to some, it may seem like, if you're in that place, and I've been in this place before, that you're praying and you're praying and you're praying and God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. And I've actually heard, you know, I've prayed this prayer, and I've heard others pray this prayer, is, God, how much longer am I going to have to deal with this? How much longer? When are you going to take this away? When are you going to fix this? What do you do when you pray and pray and pray and nothing ever changes? Does that mean that God doesn't hear your prayer? What if going through a hard time is more than you can bear? Consider James 1. It says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know, that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. You know, when I'm going through a hard time, it's really easy to get cynical about that consider it pure joy. I'm not the type that enjoys, like, looks for opportunities of, like, oh, great, this is going to make my faith grow. I've been through four reductions in force, which is having your role terminated. A reduction in force is a fancy HR term for your job ain't here no more. So I've been through four of those in my career, and each one of those, you know, the first few were like, you know, it's panicky, it's hard, it's difficult, it hurts physically, it hurts emotionally, it hurts in ways that you don't even think about until it happens to you. Each one of those times, God has always been faithful to me. Every single time, I've landed in a better place, and I look back and I thought, wow, what was I worried about? Why did I think that God wasn't going to work this out like he did the last time? Amen. But pure joy isn't the feeling that I jump to. And in fact, when I'm cynical, I think, you know, consider it pure joy is like, you know, that's like a pat on the back, like, hang in there, bro. Hope you're doing okay with all that. Be warm and well fed, but it's the Bible, and it says consider it pure joy. But I noticed something when I read this scripture, which I've read a bunch of times before, and any of you churchgoers have probably read this before, particularly going through hard times. But look at what stands out here. Let perseverance finish its work. You know, what I'm waiting for is for, let's get this thing done. Let's get it over with so I can, like, move on to whatever the next job is, whatever the next, you know, thing in life is, whatever the next hardship. You know, let me get to the times of refreshing, the times of peace if it's not a job situation. But maybe the things are still happening because perseverance hasn't finished its work. And if you're still persevering, God is still working to mature you and to complete you. Don't throw in the towel before perseverance has done its work. God uses our hardship in quite a few ways. Number one is to direct us. And I deliberately looked at a different version, the Good News Bible. We all may have different feelings on different versions of the Bible, but I like how this was stated. It says, sometimes it takes a painful experience to change our ways. Can anybody relate to that? Lots of hands. That's good. Audience participation. I can relate to this. You know, sometimes it does take some going through pain to change your ways. It could be sin. It could be a bad relationship, a bad situation that you're in. Sometimes it takes just going through hard times to make you realize God's directing me some other place. Another way is, to correct us. Psalm 118, 71 and 72 says, "It was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decrees. The law of your mouth is more precious to me than thousands of pieces of silver and gold." How many of you like being afflicted? Not as many hands as the previous question. But not many of you guys know this, but I struggle with anxiety and depression. And this started pretty much at a young age. And I can remember in fifth grade, I was tremendously worried about whatever it is fifth graders worry about. I think for me it was grades. I was feeling a tremendous amount of some kind of pressure. And everybody said, you know, well, you're just a worrier. You're a worried child. And, you know, time went on and, you know, I worked harder on my grades. But I remember my mom talking to me about trusting God through that. As a fifth grader, I'm thinking about, I need to trust God to help me not worry. And I remember it being a regular part of my prayer, God, help me not to worry. Well, later on in life, things got more complicated, as life, you know, kind of does. You get married, you have kids, and you have a career, and things amped up beyond what I felt like I could control. I remember waking up one time and feeling like there was somebody sitting on my chest, my arms were numb, my heart was pounding, and I literally thought, I'm having a heart attack. This is classic. I'm too young for this. You know, I do not drink, smoke. I don't do the things that heart attack people do, which I found out later is it really doesn't matter. I do have a history in our family of heart issues, but I really thought that's what it was. And then it kind of eased off, and I remembered that recurring feeling happened at the time when I had a really bad boss. The stress that I was under with this woman caused me to have repeated anxiety attacks. It's not funny. It is now that I know the epilogue, but my first year of having this woman as a boss, it was like, she's great. She thinks my ideas are cool. I'm able to do this job. And then I don't know what it was. It's like it hit the year mark. And then all of a sudden, I was not on her list of favorite people. I didn't feel like I could do anything right. And coming from, you know, being somebody who's concerned about their performance, like in fifth grade when I was worried about my grades, and in my career where I want to do a good job and get a good review and be a good person, I didn't feel physically like I could handle it. And I remembered back in the times when my mom had a bad boss. My mom was a working mom, and she had a bad boss for years. And she would come home, and I'd hear stories that didn't make much sense to me then, but, you know, my adult self could remember those stories and think, oh, she was going through the exact same thing I did. And I remember she would spend a lot of time in Psalms, and she would take little pieces of paper and write down different Psalms. And her favorite, which I still have written on a card and put in a frame, it's Psalm 118:24 that says, "This is the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." That was her attitude. She was driving to a job that she hated, a boss that hated her, that had no good to say about her, and yet she was going to rejoice and be glad in it. So I spent a lot of time in Psalms, and I highlighted a lot of Psalms. And the great thing about Psalms is the fact that you can find any emotion that you're feeling. David went through the gamut of emotions, and when that is my go-to. I found so many psalms that have to do with God being my protector, my rock, my hiding place, being hidden under his wing. And I highlighted those in blue, because, you know, sadness. Because I wanted to be able to recall those things very quickly and find those things very quickly again when I was going through another hard time. You know, anxiety and depression are difficult. I felt the way, physically, the way that I did when something bad would happen. You know, just that, you know, the clenching of your chest or whatever. But everything would be okay. I'd run through the list, like, family okay? You know, life okay? Is money in the bank? If, you know, is everybody healthy? But something just didn't feel right. And I thought back, and I remembered the faith that my mother had. And that helped me to determine that, you know, my strength is not in what my boss thinks of me. And that's a hard one for me. Because that person writes my review. That person could determine my employment, my future, my career. But if I really think about my calling, is my calling my career? Or is it to follow Jesus? It's to follow Jesus. Despite the fact that I had a bad boss. You know, and just like God always does, I tell people, God is has been my best career counselor. And just like he does, you know, God always shows me, in hindsight, in the rearview mirror, that you're in a better place. I got a different job in another part of the country, another part of the company, and a little bit later, I found out that my old boss got in trouble with HR and was being investigated, and she soon left the company. So that probably wasn't related to what I was going through or what I felt, but I felt rescued. I felt like God spared me. And the hard times that I were going through, I could always see and always feel it being better after God got involved. The next thing is to perfect us. This is a part of Romans 5. It says, we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character. Character, hope. And again, the whole glory in your sufferings part, I don't glory in my sufferings. But I always feel, because of the things I've been through in my life, I always feel like there's a magnet between me and God, because that's when I realize I need God, because I am out of gas. I can't continue on my own. I can't depend on my sense of humor to whip myself out of this, you know, funky feeling. I've got to depend on God. And what's interesting about this is that if God wants us to glory in our suffering so that it's going to build our character, it shows us that God is more interested in our character than our comfort. I am more interested in my comfort because I'd like things to be easy. I don't want to deal with conflict. I don't want to have to deal with drama. Last year was a year full of drama. Work, church, you name it. Life. It was anything but me glorying in my sufferings. But I think it added to my character. I think it added to a lot of people's character. And our relationship with God and our character are the only things that are going to take us into eternity. Think about that. Your relationship with God and your character are the only things that are going to take you to eternity. Because that's all you have. Relationship with God and whatever character that you've allowed God to build in you through your sufferings, through your trials. And as usual, it always seems like it's the hard things that build your character. You know, you're growing up, your dad may made you do something hard, men or women, or your mom. I don't, you know. It builds character. My dad used to eat raw hamburger meat. This was back in the days when I guess you could do that because you didn't have to worry about GMOs and that type of thing. He when my mom would cook and he would, he'd wad up a piece and, eat it. And I go, that's just nasty. It's like dog food. He goes, builds character, put hair on your chest. I'm like, I am fine being hairless and character-free if that's the case. But, it's never the fun things like playing with your dog or, spending time with your kids and enjoying, taking the family on a vacation that builds character. It builds memories, but it's the hard things that build character. And that's what's going to last for eternity. And the last story we're going to talk about is my best days are behind me. How many of you came into a relationship with God in high school or college? Raise your hands. How many of you feel like you look back at those days and you dream about, or you remember the things that you did and now you think like, I can't believe I did that. I mean, spiritual good things. And you think about, wow, we were out there doing this. We were out there doing that, Do you tell yourself as one of your stories is that your glory days are behind you? That now you're too old, too busy, let the younger generation do those things? There's a great philosopher from New Jersey called Bruce Springsteen. Some of you may have heard of. In his song Glory Days, there's a line that goes, I hope when I get old I don't sit around thinking about it. But I probably will. Yep, just sitting back trying to recapture a little of the glory. Well, time slips away and leaves you with nothing, mister, but boring stories of glory days. You tell yourself that story that your best days are behind you? Are you tempted to feel that way? Think about great things that you did when you were younger or smarter or, whatever, healthier. Did you know that Moses was 80 years old when he approached Pharaoh? Not the Charlton Heston Moses, who was pretty, virile and probably 40. And he was 80 years old. My mother-in-law is 81. And I can't picture an 80-year-old going up, in front of Pharaoh and saying, let my people go. And to having that sort of thing. Did you know that Abraham was 100 years old? When he became a father for the first time? 100. My dad was 46 when he had me. I was the fourth child. And as you heard from a previous communion, I was not planned. I was a surprise. And, I know when I turned 46, it's hard to deal with kids, much less a newborn. And granted, probably Abraham, because of culture, was not the involved father that, we're supposed to be today. But he was 100. Steve Gooch was considerably younger when he started Ground Zero Grace, but he'd been a Christian for decades. That's a big deal to decide through Hurricane Katrina and seeing needs, I'm going to start a foundation. I'm going to start a thing where we go around and help people in need. That's a kind of a young person thing to do. I'm not saying that Steve's not young. But he'd been a Christian for a long time when he did that. Andy and Heidi, how long have you guys been Christians? Where'd they go? How long have you guys been Christians? 42 years. Heidi, same? 30-something. See, it's just a long time. She doesn't keep up. Who decides at 42 years, 30-something years, hey, let's go to Kenya? Andy and Heidi. Your best days, your glory days are not behind you. That's awesome. The good thing about being a Christian is your glory days, if you think about the full meaning of the word glory, those days are ahead of you. No matter what you do, if you're not able to start a foundation or go to a foreign country, if what you're able to do is send a card, send a letter to somebody in prison, make a meal, show up when somebody's hurting. Those are glory days. Because you're doing those things for the glory of God. And don't let Satan tell you the lie that your glory days are over and that you're too old, too whatever, to get things done. So what's your story? With this many people, there's likely hundreds of stories. Like I said at the beginning, I couldn't go through the number of stories that you believe. These are a few that I personally feel and that some of you have told me. But if none of these relate to you, and if life is going pretty good right now and you're story-free, and the stories you tell yourself are true, then maybe your role is to love somebody enough to help them hear the right story about themselves. As we said, the thief comes in to steal. When Satan speaks to us, he lies because it's his native language. The stories that you hear are often lies because Satan is telling you those things. So if you know somebody or you hear somebody say something where you know that's not true about them, it's your job. It's your role out of love to help them say that is not your story and help them figure out what their story is. Jesus calls us to love each other as we love ourselves. And in 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, it says, love does not delight in evil but rejoices in the truth. And for most of us, the story we tell ourselves aren't true. They're lies. So if we're rejoicing in the truth and we claim to love people, and if our greatest command is to love others as ourselves, then that means we need to rejoice in the truth of other people and help them see the truth. Tell them who they are in Christ and that the truest thing about them isn't the story they're telling themselves, it's that they are made in the image of God. Speak the truth, not, and even if you're not willing to, you know, it's real easy. There's this thing at work. I work for Cox Communications, and it's a great company, and people are nice, and I'd been there like for a month, and I was still in the honeymoon phase. Still am. It's a great company. But I heard somebody refer to this concept called Cox Nice. And I said, well, what does that mean? And they said, oh, well, everybody's nice, but they don't necessarily agree with you, even though it looks like they do. I said, oh, it's kind of a bless your heart kind of thing. They smile and then talk about on your back. So that's not always the case, but there is this concept of just being nice to people and staying shallow and not really digging deeper. So if we're not willing to tell people the truth, to get in there and find the truth, then what are we here for? Why are we a church if we can't love people enough to tell our story? Or invest in somebody else's story to help them figure out what the truth is. Ephesians 4:15 says for us to speak the truth in love. Speaking the truth in love isn't always about telling somebody, you know, something about themselves. It could be telling somebody something about you. Perfect love drives out fear, right?
Yeah.
So if you believe in that perfect love that's supposed to happen right here in this fellowship, then sometimes it means risking and telling a story about who you are and what you're going through. What are your fears? What are your doubts? What is it you're going through? What's your story? We're not perfect. Jesus' love is. And Jesus' love drives out fear. Opening yourself up to tell that kind of story about yourself is hard. It's scary. Because you're tempted to think, if I tell this, they're going to think less of me. They're not going to see me the same way that they have before. They're not going to like me. They're going to judge me. I'm not as good as so-and-so. Those are true statements, because that could happen. But if it happens here, if somebody invests and trusts in that love, the perfect love that drives out fear, and tells you something, and we judge, or think less of or distance ourselves or in any way put a barrier between us and them, then God help us. We are wasting our time. There's a vulnerability that's involved in that, and it's a risk, just like anything else. But the first thing is about story is that it's yours. Your story is your story, whether it's true, whether it's not. You get to write it, but better yet, you get the author and the protector of our faith to help you finish it, to help you write the story, to write the chapters that you've messed up, that you've backspaced over and deleted. God helps you write that story. Faith helps you write that story. Don't believe the lies. Your story's yet to be told, and it's not over yet. Thank you.